This is Images. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. As we told you in the last half hour, the Las Cruces City Council is scheduled to discuss changes to the new minimum wage law on Monday. During Fronteras, Samantha Sonner reported on a proposal by Councillor Nathan Small. But of course, that is not the only possible amendment being discussed. Mayor Ken Miyagashima has also put forth various ideas. And one of those proposals involves a yearly review of whether phased increases in the minimum wage will even take place. The wage is scheduled to rise to $8.40 in January, $9.20 in 2016, and $10.10 in 2017. Critics say it would be difficult to judge the effect of wage increases on the overall economy because there are so many factors to consider. And as Councillor Olga Pedroza told KRWG, some of those influences aren't even local in nature because we're in a global economy. It's an easy time to remind people about that since lower gas prices, strongly influenced by global factors, are giving consumers more money to spend on other things.
I hate to say this, but we are a very sweet little city and like that, but we are also part of the world. And there are global things going on that affect our sweet little city and our economy. And so to decide 840 has this effect, 850 has this effect, just like you said, is going to be a very, very divisive exercise.
Councillors Pedroza, Nathan Small, and Gil Sorg all voted against the minimum wage increase, saying the ordinance should have been on the ballot for voters to decide. Now those three councillors are the target of a recall election campaign by the group New Mexicans for a Better Tomorrow. Campaign manager Jeffrey Isbell told KRWG the minimum wage issue is already sacrificing jobs, and employers who want to pay less can move to El Paso, where the federal minimum wage of $7.25 is used.
Well, we can already look and see that there are businesses that have chosen not to come to Las Cruces are now contemplating moving out of Las Cruces, costing us hundreds of jobs already just because of this minimum wage increase or even the thought of a minimum wage increase. So we're already seeing real data that's concerned a lot of people. You know, when they can move 30 minutes down to El Paso and employ people there and pay a lower wage, lower taxes.
Isbell isn't the only person to mention El Paso as an alternative for Las Cruces employers looking to avoid paying higher wages. But depending on the job, that might not be so easy. While wages vary, this week the El Paso Times reported Dish Network had 150 jobs open at its East El Paso call center. The company website says those jobs have a $10 an hour starting salary with significant bonus potential, 401k with company matched funds, tuition reimbursement, complimentary Dish programming, medical, dental, and vision insurance, and paid vacation and sick time. Moreover, high-skill jobs also sometimes pay more in El Paso. For instance, starting teachers make $34,000 a year in Las Cruces public schools, while the El Paso Independent School District starts its teachers at $44,000, $10,000 more, and no state income tax for employees who live in Texas. But currently, some economic development officials use low labor costs as a way to promote Las Cruces to employers. On its website under business costs, the Mesilla Valley Economic Development Alliance says, quote, labor costs in Las Cruces are well below national averages. Median wage rates for skilled production workers are 18% lower than the national average. Administrative support median wages are approximately 20% lower than the national average. End quote. It's another reminder that the minimum wage discussion in Las Cruces is part of a larger economic picture and one that may have much larger implications. This is Images. I'm Fred Martino. Thank you so much for being with us. Deporting felons, not families. That was a key takeaway from President Obama's address on immigration. The president could provide relief to as many as 5 million undocumented immigrants. And as Simon Thompson reports, some local people among that group say it's long overdue.
Soledad Pisana came to the United States in 1996 from Talamantes, Chihuahua, Mexico. She says she escaped an abusive husband and gave her first daughter a chance at a better life.
Desde niña sufrí abuso.
I was abused ever since I was a child, since I was 10 years old. And when I got married, the abuse continued. And in reality, my life has been very difficult. All my life, I have suffered abuse. Coming here was very difficult.
After wearing out a welcome, staying with her brother in El Paso, Pisana met and married her second husband and gave birth to her second daughter, Andrea, who's an American citizen. But that marriage also turned violent.
Even over here, I have also suffered domestic abuse.
Catholic Charities Las Cruces immigration attorney Lauren Armstrong says it's a common scenario for women lacking legal status and basic English skills. And Armstrong says support services are harder to access in areas with border checkpoints.
We have victims of domestic violence who live on the Otero side of Chaparral community who can't get to court for protections of order of protections against their abusers because they can't get through the checkpoint. And we have people who are terrified to call law enforcement because they're afraid there will be inquiries made into their immigration status.
After 7 years of cleaning houses for cash under the table with her eldest daughter Cynthia, Pisana was able to get out of that abusive situation, but only with the help from people in the community, like a La Mesa farmer who took the Pisanas in.
He didn't want me to pay rent anymore, just clean the yard and collect pecans.
Pisana says every day she lives in fear of being deported and prays to God that she won't be separated from her daughters.
If somebody doesn't like you or somebody has a problem with you, the first thing they think about is, oh, I'm going to call immigration on you.
But Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, never came. Following two consecutive Obama executive directives in 2011 and then in 2012, ICE has prioritized the deportation of undocumented people with criminal backgrounds over families or those who came to the U.S. as children. The president expanded the reach of that policy last week.
If you've been in America for more than 5 years, if you have children who are American citizens or legal residents, if you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation. You can come out of the shadows.
According to the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, there are about 25,000 undocumented people living in just 10 counties in southern New Mexico. Attorney Armstrong says there are as many as 10,000 undocumented immigrants, like Pisana, who could benefit from the president's action.
We came to this country to look for a better future for my daughter and a good education. We have been waiting 19 years for an opportunity.
The action does not grant eligible undocumented immigrants like Pisana welfare benefits, green cards, citizenship, or pathways to them, but it will provide work visas, a way to pay taxes, and protections from deportation, though only temporarily. Many Republicans, like New Mexico Congressman Steve Pierce, are questioning the legality of Obama's action and are calling it amnesty.
We're rewarding behavior that is not in comport with the law. And that, anytime you do that, that is an amnesty. That is the official definition of amnesty when people do not, when they're not held accountable for their actions.
According to the U.S. Department of State's Visa Bulletin, eligible Mexican applicants for U.S. residency are waiting between 18 and 20 years. Steve Pierce says executive orders are not fair to the people waiting and may encourage illegal immigration. But Pisana says people come to the U.S. to escape poverty and violence. Though she says living in the U.S. illegally is hard, it's better than Mexico, where she would not be able to access domestic abuse counseling or afford education or medicine for her daughters.
I am very appreciative of this country because I was able to help my daughters get ahead in life. This country has given me a lot.
Pisana says the temporary work visa will allow her to take on more clients and make more money. She says she might be able to afford a better place to live and maybe a more reliable car. But she's worried about the future and what will happen to her family when President Obama leaves office.
Vamos a estar juntas siempre.
They are not going to separate us. We are going to be together forever.
All of Obama's executive directives providing relief to undocumented immigrants could be rescinded by an immigration reform bill or by the next president. For KRWG, I'm Simon Thompson.
A case now before the courts in Texas may set a precedent in alleged racial profiling cases brought against the Border Patrol. If it succeeds, it would allow people unlawfully seized in roving patrols to sue an individual agent. Roving patrols are separate from immigration checkpoints placed within 100 miles of the border with Mexico. They were created after a 1950s Department of Justice ruling that 100 miles is a reasonable distance to pull someone over without probable cause. But roving patrols beyond that line are legally distinct. Here's Fronteras reporter Lauren Matalon.
If you live near the border, you've likely gone through an immigration checkpoint.
Good afternoon, ma'am. How are you doing today? U.S. Border Patrol.
Checkpoints are within 100 miles of the border, legacies of a federal ruling in 1953 that said agents don't need probable cause to stop you within that zone. Probable cause is central to the Fourth Amendment, one meant to protect against arbitrary searches. But numerous Border Patrol stations in Texas send out roving patrols into the state's interior. And immigration lawyer David Anton Armendariz believes that some of those roving patrols violate the Fourth Amendment.
There are a high number of arrests that take place in any given day by these agents far from the U.S. border.
Armendariz is now before the courts, alleging that roving patrols sometimes engage in racial profiling. He contends that profiling became an issue in the post-9/11 creation of the Department of Homeland Security, which in turn affected the Border Patrol.
After the reorganization of all the agencies after 9/11, the Border Patrol shifted their primary responsibility from worksite enforcement to whatever was left. And that which was left is simply roving patrol. ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, took over worksite enforcement. So you had these stations that have been there for an awful long time and these agents that have been there for an awful long time, and their duties suddenly shifted.
Statistics obtained under the Freedom of Information Act by reporter Jeremy Schwartz of the Austin American-Statesman bear that out. Agents arrested more than 40,000 people between 2005 and 2013 at 9 inland border patrol stations in Texas, some as far as 350 miles away from the border, an average of 10 people a day.
They have learned to focus on certain types of vehicles and certain types of persons, namely Hispanic men in trucks.
The law goes all over the charts.
That's attorney Liz Rogers. She understands both sides of the issue. She was an assistant U.S. attorney before becoming an assistant federal public defender. In both positions, she focused on the border.
Many of us on the defense side believe that they really stopped somebody because they looked Hispanic. You know, in other parts of the country, they call it driving while black. But the Fifth Circuit overwhelmingly has supported law enforcement in those issues since the 70s.
The Fifth Circuit includes Texas, but it's made other rulings showing that the 100-mile limit is legally blurry. In 2012, the Fifth Circuit said the arrest of an undocumented immigrant 170 miles from the border was illegal.
They can consider that somebody's Hispanic, but it can't be the only reason.
In another case, a veteran agent's deposition showed the agent had pulled over work crews far from the border. But the agent said only half the people stopped were arrested, implying that many U.S. citizens were also stopped. Now there's another case pending before the Fifth Circuit, launched by Alejandro Garcia de la Paz. He was in a car 90 miles from the border when an agent stopped him and three others on a country road.
Oh, my stomach just shaking, or I don't know how you say it.
Garcia de la Paz's lawsuit claiming the stop was illegal has now been argued before the Fifth Circuit. The decision is imminent, and a victory would set a precedent allowing individual agents to be sued for wrongful action in roving patrols. The vice president of the Border Patrol Union, Sean Moran, says agents are entitled to make arrests anywhere.
Border Patrol agents don't pull out a map and look to see if they're within 100 miles. If they encounter somebody that is here illegally in this country and does not have the proper documentation to remain here, they will be arrested and processed by Border Patrol agents.
In an email, a senior Border Patrol official writes that the agency doesn't tolerate racial profiling. I'm Lorne Matalon.
This is Images. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Today we meet a Honduran woman who fled her country after getting death threats. A judge granted her asylum this past week. Here's Fronteras reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe.
When I met her, Mixeli Gavidia had been a free woman for less than 24 hours. She and her two sons spent close to 5 months in an immigrant detention center in Artesia, New Mexico.
On Wednesday, they pack their bags one last time before heading off to meet Gavidia's boyfriend in Louisiana. The day before, an immigration judge granted Gavidia asylum. She can now legally live and work in the United States. In a year, she'll be eligible for a green card.
In Honduras, I run my own business. I had a bookstore, sold school supplies, and sold fried plantains with my sisters.
Gavidia also volunteered as a community organizer and worked on the campaign of her town's future mayor. One day, she began receiving threatening phone calls.
Supongo esas llamadas, pues, eran de las maras.
I assume the calls were from the gangs. They are the only ones that do this. They told me I deserve to die.
Gang violence in Honduras is among the deadliest in the world. One morning, Gavidia woke to find her dog and pig poisoned to death. Then a friend she knew from campaigning door to door was murdered.
In
my town, people are killed or they simply disappear. Nobody says anything, because to open your mouth is a death sentence.
A week later, she fled. Her boyfriend, a day laborer, borrowed $9,000 to pay a smuggler. When she reached the Rio Grande, she boarded an inflatable raft with 12 other people. Once on U.S. soil, they turned themselves into the Border Patrol. Days later, she was on a bus to Artesia. On the way, the bus was struck by lightning.
Solo miramos aquel juego que salió así del autobús y
we saw flames coming from below the bus and heard a loud bang. I held my children and thought, oh God, this is the end.
Luckily, no one was injured. They switched buses and continued. When Gavidia arrived in Artesia, the detention center had been opened less than a month. The facility was part of the government's response to a mass influx of Central Americans at the southern border. Gavidia says the months she spent in detention were the most miserable of her life. The children, she says, suffered the worst.
There was a boy in the cafeteria whose mom was pressuring him to eat, and the boy, just 4 years old, said, "Mommy, I would rather die than stay here in detention."
An asylum officer who interviewed Gavidia initially dismissed her case. That was before she had an attorney. By the time a team of volunteer lawyers descended on Artesia, some 200 women and children had already been deported. With legal representation, Gavidia got a second chance to present her case. 3 months later, she won asylum. Sharing the news with other immigrant women was a bittersweet moment.
They cried, partly because they were happy for me, and partly because their own futures were so uncertain.
Gavidia says detaining families is an inhumane response to illegal immigration. She adds, it's also not an effective deterrent.
I knew the journey to the United States would be risky, but my life in Honduras was already at risk, and I would rather die fighting than die defeated.
Gavidia's case is the most recent victory for the volunteer attorneys working in Artesia. Since this summer, they've won 10 out of 10 asylum cases. In El Paso, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
As we conclude our look at border issues this week on Images, Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, and representatives of New Mexico's U.S. senators heard a mix of compliments and complaints from the public at a recent Border Task Force meeting. Samantha Sonner was there.
The Southwest New Mexico Border Task Force meeting gives the Senate's office a chance to hear problems and updates from the New Mexico border. Ronald LeBlanc, the patrol agent in charge at Deming, says activity at their station has been steady.
We have not had a marked increase in apprehensions within the Deming area of responsibility. What we are seeing is some areas that we're able to deploy our resources more efficiently than we have before because of additional technology we've received recently.
The new technology helps them to patrol their coverage area better.
What that's actually allowing us to do is get into areas that were extremely remote before and allow our agents to deploy more efficiently and make some apprehensions and interdictions that we weren't getting before.
Billy Thatcher, Department Head of English at New Mexico State University, has moderated the meetings the past few years and says the agencies usually respond to the public's concerns.
Well, 3 months ago, we have a number of American citizens who live in Palomas right across the border, and we're not being treated very well by American federal agents as they were crossing back in the United States. We got the community, these people worked with Customs and Border Protection, and we've seen a 180 shift in the way they're being treated. That was a wonderful accomplishment.
Ranchers at the meeting complained the Mexican cattle was still able to break through the fences that were there, posing a risk to American cattle. Thatcher says it isn't the first time the complaint has been raised.
The fence issue has been going on for 2 or 3 years, as long as I have been here. And the more we discuss it, the more we realize that it's one of those things that kind of falls into cracks in terms of jurisdiction. It's not really the Border Patrol's authority to maintain the fence like that, according to what I've heard. And then we're not quite sure who's responsible. So that is something that I've challenged this group openly that we're going to work on.
Thatcher says that there was more praise at this meeting than there usually is, but praise is not always a good thing.
Critique is what we want to hear as well. I mean, this is what the senator's offices need to hear. It's their constituency, and there's red tape. That's why the senators have field representatives. That's to work through the red tape and kind of bring some of these agencies together to be creative. So we hope that happens.
Other complaints were raised after a presentation was made on proposed upgrades to the Columbus Port of Entry. The project would cost millions of dollars, and some people at the meeting thought money would be better spent putting more enforcement on the border instead of building a new facility. For KRWG, I'm Samantha Sonner.
This is Images. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Democrats will be the minority party for the first time in decades when the New Mexico House of Representatives begins its legislative session in 2015. Anthony Moreno spoke with a current House Democratic leader to find out what to expect from the party in the upcoming session.
Current New Mexico House Majority Whip Antonio Momayasis says he expects some changes when the Republicans take control of the New Mexico House of Representatives for the 52nd legislative session.
Their agenda is twofold. Number one, it's shrinking government. Don't build roads, bridges, buildings. Don't build, which hurts our economy. And number two is voter suppression. They're going to be pushing voter ID laws, which intuitively makes sense. I mean, everyone who's listening to this radio show probably has an ID, but not everybody does. And so you can either make voting easier for people and expand our democracy, or you can make it more difficult for people, restrict the franchise, and maintain power that way.
Representative Maestas says that there may be some areas where Democrats and Republicans may be able to find common ground in the upcoming session.
One thing we are hoping to accomplish is criminal justice reform. We've had a bipartisan effort, Republicans, Democrats, Senate, House, to try to alleviate the stress on the criminal justice system that takes our eye off the ball of violent criminals. There's so much emphasis on nonviolent drug offenses and other nonviolent crimes that violent crimes are not getting the time and attention they deserve. So hopefully we can pass a criminal justice reform bill that alleviates jail overcrowding and increases public safety by prioritizing violent criminals.
KRWG is waiting for a response from New Mexico House Republicans regarding the upcoming legislative session. The 60-day session begins January 20th, 2015. For KRWG, I'm Anthony Moreno.
Some big local news this week. New Mexico State University will have a new athletic director in January. Mario Mocha has been appointed. The Aggie graduate has served as director of athletics at Southern Illinois University since 2006. As part of his NMSU contract, he will make $240,000 a year plus incentives. At a news conference this week, he addressed the Aggie football program, which has 2 wins and 9 losses this season.
We had a tough loss in football on Saturday, okay? But we will be focusing on football, and we will make sure that they have the resources to compete at the highest level. Okay, it's going to take everybody's help. We're going to ask a lot of people in the community. We're going to ask a lot of alums all over the place. But that has got to be and will be a focus of our administration. I also talked to Coach Menzies. Basketball has always been the crown jewel of this institution. It's got a great spotlight on it, and I look forward to working with him to make sure we keep our winning ways in basketball.
Mocha graduated from NMSU in 1989. He was captain of the Aggie baseball team and went on to play in the Detroit Tigers minor league system. He'll take over the athletics department at NMSU effective January 5th for outgoing director McKinley Boston. Well, finally on the program, something we've been following for some time. After months of reviewing books and hearing testimony on factual errors and biased views, the Texas State Board of Education has approved social studies textbooks. Ryan Poppy has more on the extremely controversial outcome.
Beyond the conservative and left-leaning nonprofit citations of biased content, there were also over 3,000 factual errors that textbook review committees missed. For that reason, the board considered postponing the entire vote. Amarillo Republican board member Marty Raleigh reminded his fellow members that textbook publishers have the authority to edit their own material after adoption.
They can make all kinds of changes unless it relates to their TEKS coverage. And so for that reason, I think we've done the best we can to salvage the situation.
The board did eventually approve all but one textbook publisher's selection because of those factual errors. Another, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, removed their books because they refused to include material on Moses' impact on the Founding Fathers and how the U.S. Constitution was based on the Old Testament, which are Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills standards. The Texas Freedom Network's Kathy Miller says she wouldn't be surprised if more publishers skip the state board review process.
School districts are allowed to buy books that the State Board of Education has not adopted, so this publisher can still sell their books across Texas. The publisher said that their book is a national book, and some of the changes being required here in Texas would have interfered with their ability to sell that book.
The state board will meet just after the first of the year to go over any final changes. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
That's Images for this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thank you so much for being with us. Before we go, we want to remind you about a couple of things. First off, we have a big holiday concert event coming up, and you'll find all the details at the top of the region's homepage, krwg.org. It's the El Paso Brass Holiday Concert, 7 o'clock on Thursday, December 11th at the Rio Grande Theater. And we are so excited. We hope to see you out there. You can get tickets coming up for this event at the office, the KRWG office in Milton Hall on the NMSU campus. During our regular business hours, that's 8 until noon or 1 until 5, Monday through Friday. You can also pick up tickets during their regular business hours at the Cutter Gallery at the corner of University and El Paseo. By the way, you don't have to stop by the actual KRWG office. If you want to buy tickets, you can also call us during business hours. The phone number is 575-646-2222. So please do join us. You'll have all those details again if you missed anything at the top of the homepage, krwg.org, the El Paso Brass Holiday Concert, 7 o'clock, Thursday, December 11th at the Rio Grande Theater. We always look forward to seeing you for that wonderful holiday events. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.